Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life, and by Cancer Treatment Centers of America in Philadelphia.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. I'm on a mission to see the most complex computer on Earth. I'm in a tiled, bare room. It's a little bit cold in here. And on a metal table in the middle of the room, I can make out a round shape under a blue towel.
This is a brain. We'll unveil it here.
I'm with Robert Ownby. He heads the autopsy unit at Drexel University College of Medicine in Philadelphia.
This is my resident, Ashley Lentini. How much did this brain weigh, Ashley? Do you know?
I think it was around 1,100 to 1,200 grams. Okay. 2.6 pounds, yeah.
The brain on the table looks small, vulnerable somehow. Ownby examines brains as part of medical autopsies, and he starts to explain all of the different brain regions to me.
This is your frontal lobe. Mm-hmm. So this is probably the one that makes us the most human. This is where a lot of our cognitive abilities are, emotions, all those
kind
of...
Impulse control.
Impulse control.
Impulse control is a big one, yeah.
Correct. So this is the frontal.
As he takes through the mechanics, I start to think about the person this brain used to belong to. I don't know much about him, just that he was a man. But I'm thinking about his memories of his parents, his first kiss, maybe his children being born, the big milestones, but then also the millions of small details that once made up his life. This brain used to hold all of that. And I get a little bit choked up.
So when you look at this, it doesn't look as impressive as it perhaps should, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do you think about all that is in there?
It is amazing. For the most part, we don't understand the vast majority of the things that go on in the brain. The number of connections that are in here, it's really a wondrous organ. Really, I'm kind of in awe anytime I do look at a brain and how this mass of gray, tan tissue does so much. It controls every part of our body.
On today's show, we will explore this wondrous organ, the brain, what we're learning about it, how it works, and how we can intervene when things go wrong. And let's start with that. There's a lot of research now on the role of the brain in mental illness, but somehow it still seems like psychiatrists end up operating in the dark a lot of times. Medications don't work for all people, neither does therapy. There is one treatment that seems to be very effective for severe depression or psychosis. It's shock therapy. Nowadays, it's called electroconvulsive therapy, or ECT. Versions of this have been around for nearly a century, but we still don't know exactly how it works. And it's also one of the most polarizing treatments in medicine. Alana Gordon looked into why and why that might be changing.
All throughout her teens, Elise Hunt would get panic attacks. She turned inward, cutting and burning her own body. Then,
I would hear voices and see things.
Really scary stuff. She was diagnosed with severe depression, with psychosis. She got help through therapy and medications. But last year, at the age of 29, she relapsed. She could not get out of bed.
And it was just like I wouldn't eat or I would eat too much. It just depended on the day.
She says she was hospitalized twice.
But I was suicidal both times, and I was ready to go.
Medicines weren't working. Then came these words, electroconvulsive therapy. Would she consider it?
I kind of shot my doctor down right away. I was like, oh no, I'm not doing that.
Hunt's reaction is common. ECT has been an icon for medical abuse in the public mind. It can conjure up some pretty grisly images. The perception is perpetuated all over pop culture.
I wouldn't want you to break those perfect porcelain cap teeth when the juice hits your brain.
Just last year, the film Suicide Squad showed some version of ECT being used as torture. Google ECT and this disturbing scene pops up of a woman being strapped down and convulsing in pain in the BBC TV show White Heat.
You mean, Chief?
And of course, there's the Jack Nicholson character in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
What's that?
Conductant.
A little dabble, do you? Right, Mr. Jackson?
It was just, it was scary to me because I still thought of it like that they didn't put people to sleep for it or that it was like a torture or something.
Then she saw this different video. It was done by a guy she'd connected with through her support community, and it totally upended her understanding of the treatment.
So, you know, I get wheeled into the treatment room. There is just this little box sitting right next to me.
This is Peter Cornish. He posted a video on YouTube of him getting ECT at a Salt Lake City hospital. I talked with him and his wife, Anne, about what the video shows.
During the procedure, he is asleep and there is no recollection for him.
In the video, Anne is standing, smiling over Peter, who's lying on a bed. Everything seems calm.
Okay, here we go with the electrodes.
So then they put the nodes on his forehead.
That's where the shocks get administered. Again, Peter's out. He's also been given paralytic medicine.
That was the shock. He's having a seizure now.
His face and his right hand flinch.
And literally within a couple of minutes, Peter then is being wheeled out to kind of a recovery area where within 5 minutes or so, he's starting to wake up a little bit.
I honestly do say for me, going through an actual ECT shock treatment, it's better than going to the dentist. I say that with absolute honesty.
Even Peter admits he was wary when he first heard of ECT. But he pummeled even deeper into his depression. And after 10 years, he finally considered it. To many psychiatrists, ECT is an essential treatment for severe depression. A no-brainer. So why the disconnect for patients like Peter Cornish and Elise Hunt? Jonathan Sadowski has spent the last 15 years looking for answers.
I found these incredibly bifurcated images of, on the one hand, something close to a war crime, on the other hand, a safe, humane, effective treatment.
Sadowski's a medical historian in Cleveland. He says this split dates back to the origins of the therapy itself. In the early 1900s, psychiatrists thought seizures could help treat schizophrenia.
And this was at first done with chemicals, and it was called chemical convulsive therapy.
It sucked for patients.
It inspired a lot of fear. There was evidently a moment of terror after taking the medicine and before the seizure came on that patients hated. One Cleveland psychiatrist I met with who remembered back then said, we had to chase the patients around the room, the doctors and the patients, to get them to take their, it was called metrazole, was the main substance used to induce the convulsions.
Then, moving into the 1930s, came along these two Italian doctors.
Ugo Cerletti and Lucio Bini were actually trying to develop a treatment that would be safer, more humane, and less frightening to patients.
Bini, the story goes, was at a slaughterhouse one day.
He noticed that they used electric shocks to stun the pigs before slaughtering them, and he noticed that sometimes the shocks induced convulsions.
They tried it on humans, and voila, ECT was born and exploded in the field of psychiatry. It had therapeutic benefits, but the treatment was often used inappropriately, without consent or general anesthesia. It was used to, quote, treat gay people, and
there's also evidence of ward attendants and other people in clinical situations using it to discipline patients on hospital wards.
It really was used for punishment. This checkered past made ECT part of a bigger anti-psychiatry movement. And this negative reputation has remained ingrained in the social psyche. That's really frustrating for psychiatrists like Steven Siner.
So many things have changed, not just in ECT, but in psychiatry in general.
In the U.S., modern ECT is mainly used for severe depression. Informed consent is required, and the patients always get an anesthetic. Siner has been performing ECT for 2 decades at McLean Hospital near Boston, which does some 10,000 treatments a year.
It's indispensable, and you know, when you really need it, it's going to be the most useful thing that you have.
He describes ECT as the hammer in the depression toolkit. It's kind of blunt, More than that, it's an essential option. Still,
you know, not everything's a nail. And I think, you know, we have to be careful about how we use ECT. And that's evolved over the years.
Today, ECT is more directed and individualized. Patients go through a series of treatments, and the number and frequency depends on a lot of factors, like the patient's initial condition and how they respond. Siner says those who benefit the most are those who need it the most.
What ECT is basically doing is resetting the brain. It's going to bring you back to your baseline. So we say, you know, if you were a happy-go-lucky person before you got depressed, that's what we're aiming for. If you were kind of a glasses half empty person, then that's where we're aiming for. If you're a Yankees fan, you're still going to be a Yankees fan. We don't have a strong enough treatment for that.
But ECT does come with trade-offs, even today. The most common complaint is memory loss, something many patients say they were not fully prepped for. Peter Cornish, the guy who made a video of his own treatment, says he feels like he's in a fog after ECT.
For me, what I feel happens is after about 3 or 4 treatments in a series, I get to the point where my brain gets fatigued. And to put it in more layman's terms, I got to sort of go into zombie mode.
The memory loss from ECT typically falls into one of 2 categories. Dr. Siner at McLean Hospital says the first is the ability to lay down and store new memories.
But the good news is that that effect tends to fade within and go back to normal within about a month after ECT.
But ECT can affect retrograde memory. That's memories you had before the treatment.
Most commonly, that's in the few months prior to ECT. You know, and it tends to be more things you did once and then didn't really think about it again. So it's not so much people won't forget who their daughter is, but they might forget a piano recital they went to of their daughter's 3 months ago.
Siner says it's hard to test and track this, but they're figuring out ways to minimize the impact. That includes the type, level, and way electric impulses are administered. But even Siner doesn't fully understand how ECT works. Like the inner workings of depression and the mind itself, ECT is surrounded by mystery. Dr. Sarah Lisenby is a longtime researcher in this area and is a director at the National Institute of Mental Health. She says the science is catching up.
As much as today's ECT is dramatically different than it used to be in the 30s and 40s when it first came out, likewise, ECT of the future, I think it's going to look very different than the way we do it today. And that's really inspiring and exciting.
Lisenby says advances in brain imaging are leading to new understandings of ECT, like the way it affects certain parts of the brain and stimulates neurons or brain cells. More alternative treatments are in the works. But as complicated as the brain is, Lisenby says electricity is central to its very existence.
The amazing thing is we've got electrical currents in our brains right now. As we're talking to each other, as you're listening to me, that's how the brain works. Neuronal activity, the way that we think, the way that we move, the way that we, you know, ponder the world and understand ourselves, all of this brain activity is electrical activity.
Lisenby worries too many people carry an inaccurate view of ECT. And that it's created a huge gap between those who could really benefit from it and those who actually get it. For Peter Cornish, who posted that video on YouTube, nothing annoys him more than finding inaccurate images of ECT perpetuated on TV and online. So he openly talks about it, kind of the way you might tell a neighbor about your trip to the grocery store. He remembers this one time he showed up at his regular coffee shop after being away for several months getting treatment.
And I had my oldest son, Ian, in the car with me, and someone said, "Peter, we haven't seen you. What's going on?"
He went with the truth.
"Oh, I've actually been pretty depressed, and I just went through shock treatment, and it's been really successful for me." And that person, who was not someone I knew very well, said, "Hey, that's really interesting. I know someone who's been through it, and it's really cool to be able to talk about it." But then I think about it, and I'm driving off, and I'm going, "Uh-oh, I have just embarrassed my son." He was like probably 16. Actually, he was 17, 18 at that stage. And he turned to me and he said, "Dad, it is so cool that you can talk to people like that."
That
That was Alana Gordon reporting. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about our brains on today's show. And right now we're exploring what we can do when things go wrong. One very common and really devastating thing that can go wrong in our brains is a stroke. Most strokes are caused by a clot blocking a blood vessel. That clot cuts off oxygen supply to the brain, and if the pathway doesn't reopen, brain cells start to die quickly. That can mean brain damage or death. The first big breakthrough in stroke treatment came 20 years ago with a chemical clot-busting medicine called TPA. But the problem is, it doesn't work all the time. But now there's another tool that lets doctors treat massive strokes in a different way. Here's Irina Zhorov with more.
On July 17, 2014, Kurt Hinrichs of Gladstone, Missouri, went to bed early. When his wife joined him, she woke him with her snoring. That often happened. This, in turn, woke his wife, Alice.
At first, it was like, what's going on? Are you dreaming? Are you sleepwalking?
And I am thinking that this is a nightmare.
He wasn't responding to anything Alice asked him.
And I finally just grabbed his face between my hands and trying to make him look at me in the eyes and said, if you can't tell me right now that you're okay, I'm calling 911. And there was no change, nothing at all.
When the paramedics arrived, Kurt wasn't speaking and his entire right side was paralyzed. They recognized that Kurt was having a stroke.
When they wheeled Kurt out of the house, I think was the hardest part for me because it's like I knew at that point in time he was not going to come back home through that door. If he was home, I knew he would be bedridden or in a wheelchair or handicapped somehow, but I really didn't have a lot of hope that my husband would be normal and coming back home ever.
Kurt, speeding towards St. Luke's Hospital in Kansas City, had his own reckoning.
That's when I realized that this was not a nightmare, that this was the truth, that I was awake, but there was something major and massively wrong with me.
At the hospital, doctors got Kurt on TPA, the clot-busting medicine, but the chemicals weren't really working. That's when nurses approached Alice and asked if the doctors could perform a new kind of mechanical procedure on her husband. She'd never heard of it. It's called mechanical thrombectomy, but she agreed.
They got me on the table, and the last thing that I remembered was a huge bank of screens coming over me. And I'm thinking, what is that for? And I was out.
Over the next 20 minutes, doctors inserted a catheter into his femoral artery in the groin. They wove the catheter up into the aorta, the main artery in the body, then into a carotid artery, which takes blood into the head and neck, and finally into the brain vessel where the clot was located. Those huge banks of screens helped doctors see where they were going as they steered the catheter towards the clot.
Once it gets into the brain, that's where it becomes a little trickier because the arteries make a lot of sharp turns and curves and do become very small and somewhat delicate.
That's Brett Cachera, a stroke neurologist at the University of Pennsylvania. When the catheter reaches the clot, the doctor pushes out a little wire inside it. Cachera shows one of these devices to me in his office. It looks like a very thin little fishing net on the end of a metal wire.
That little thing is deployed into the clot, and it catches the clot in the little mesh. It gets trapped in there.
Once it's trapped in there, the little net with clot in tow is pulled back into the catheter, and the whole thing is pulled out of the body.
Somewhat analogous to like a plumber who comes and uses the plumbing snake to pull a clog out of your drain.
If successful, blood flow is immediately restored to the brain.
Many times within 10 or 15 minutes of that happening, the paralysis will melt away. Their ability to speak will completely return. So it can be quite a remarkable, almost miraculous recovery that you can see right in front of you.
After Kurt Hinrichs' procedure, he was able to start wiggling his right arm and leg. His speech returned soon after.
My wife went home because my three kids did not know anything had happened, and she wanted to be there to tell them. So she came back about 4 hours later, and when she walked into my room, She got to the door, and I looked at her, and about this clearly, I asked her, how is your morning?
What, my morning? What about your morning? And I just kind of stopped, and I looked behind me, and I looked at him, and I'm like, my gosh, what happened while I was gone?
Kurt is what doctors sometimes call a Lazarus patient. A massive stroke like the one he suffered can kill people or leave them paralyzed and non-communicative. But after the intervention, he walked out of the hospital without any serious lasting effects. In 2015, after several studies demonstrated just how effective the procedure is for certain stroke patients, new guidelines made it standard care. But Guillermo Linares, director of neurointerventional services at Temple University Hospital, says not all patients who could benefit are getting it yet. It turns out figuring out how to mastermind the systems to coordinate such care is even harder than fishing a clot out of a brain.
The delivery of the therapy in hospitals, I think, is relatively easy when you compare it to what is needed in society at large in order for this therapy to be available.
With both the clot-busting medication and mechanical thrombectomy, it's a race against time. They have to be administered very quickly, within hours of symptoms.
So when a patient becomes symptomatic, there has to be a very low threshold for calling emergency medical services. And the ambulance has to arrive quickly. The stroke has to be identified. The patient has to be brought to a stroke center.
And on and on. Many disparate pieces have to fall into place simultaneously. The coordination has to happen within a hospital, but perhaps even more importantly, it has to happen among hospitals. Not all hospitals can perform this procedure. In rural areas especially, which often lack hospitals that can perform a mechanical thrombectomy, medical teams have to figure out what to do with stroke patients.
As soon as emergency medical services get to you, should they drive you to the closest possible hospital, or should they drive past a smaller hospital in order to get you to a larger comprehensive stroke center where more options may be available? Well, there's risks and benefits to either path.
Some cities have put out guidelines directing paramedics to follow one path or another. Many haven't. But figuring out a clear, organized method to get patients help quickly will be one of the next big advances in stroke care. Linares says healthcare providers have developed systems for other major issues, like heart attacks.
That is exactly what we're trying to do right now, is to organize ourselves so that time, which we know is brain, time is brain, we can do this and we can do it really quickly for the people that need it.
That was Irina Zhorov reporting. 800,000 people in the U.S. suffer strokes each year. If you want to see a picture of the clot that was once lodged in Kurt Hinrich's brain, it could have caused a lot of damage if it hadn't gotten pulled out. We've got a picture of it on our website. That's whyy.org/thepulse. This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. We're talking about the brain today on the show. So far, it's been the human brain, but let's move on to other animals. Certain kinds of birds and fish at times move in huge groups, as if they are all part of one organism with one brain. Herring do this, shad do it, in starlings we call it a murmuration, and scientists are trying to figure out exactly how they do this. How does it work? Paige Flager is here now. She's been looking into this. Hey, Paige.
Hey, Maiken.
And Paige, you are a total dork about these things.
Yeah, I've been nerding out pretty hard. I've been watching videos of starling murmurations, which is a kind of small brown bird or schools of fish. But I really wanted to see it for myself in person. And I thought I'd go to some beautiful field. But instead, I ended up at Atlantic County's landfill in New Jersey to meet a guy named Bert Hickson.
Hi, Bert. I'm Paige.
Hi, Paige. Nice to meet you.
Now, he works there as the landfill's resident wildlife biologist.
Why does the landfill have a resident biologist?
The landfill is really close to the airport, and so basically his job is to herd these groups of birds away from airspace to prevent them from flying into planes, kind of like that flock of geese did to Captain Sully's airplane where he had to land in the Hudson River. So anyways, I hopped in Hickson's white pickup truck.
Long way up.
Yes.
And he starts driving us up the side of the landfill, which almost looks like a giant sand dune. The windows are open and the wind is wafting the smell of garbage into the truck. On the console in between us is a pair of fancy birding binoculars and what looks like two small guns.
Don't be alarmed, these aren't pistols. They're pyrotechnics launchers.
The landfill is surrounded by tall pine trees in all directions, and off in the distance is the Atlantic City skyline. Hickson points down at a flock of more than 200 glossy brown birds.
Okay, so this is what we have. This is what we call the active area. You can see there's a smattering of starlings there. And what we're doing is we're covering last night's garbage.
Hickson fires the pistol out of the window and a murmuration starts to happen.
There they go. Wow.
As soon as the birds reach the same place in the sky, they assume this formation, perfectly spaced out. They begin this dance, a cloud of birds moving in perfect synchronicity, soaring up and swooping down, changing direction together seamlessly. The whole thing is silent. The birds don't chirp at all. And it's so beautiful that I almost forget that we're watching from on top of a giant mountain of garbage. So why do these birds do this? Turns out it's about shared risk and shared benefit.
So if there's one predator coming in and there are 1,000 of you starlings and it's a good predator, it is going to get one guaranteed. You have one chance in 1,000 of being taken instead of being off on your own and the predator comes after you and it's just you.
That's Kevin McGowan, a biologist with the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. McGowan says it's not that these animals are moving as though they have one mind, but really that they have the same exact thought. Avoid the predator by hiding behind your buddies. All of the animals that exhibit this behavior, including different kinds of birds or fish, have a few things in common. They look the same.
You don't want to stand out in a crowd because standing out gets you noticed and getting noticed gets you eaten.
And?
They're tasty, tender, and delicious, I suppose. There are things that want to eat them, and they're usually smallish and vulnerable.
One of the most striking things about these group behaviors, McGowan says, is that there's no leader. No one bird or one fish is telling the others which way to go. I called up Andrea Cavagna, a physicist at the University of Rome.
Hello?
Cavagna studies collective behavior, and he's a leading scientist on how these animals move the way that they do. He told me each individual bird doesn't need to communicate with the whole flock. Instead, they just need to imitate their 7 to 10 closest neighbors. When they do that, the flock looks like it's moving as one, no matter how many birds are part of the system. Cavagna says it's kind of like a giant game of telephone, except the birds are passing a movement instead of a phrase.
If there is a flock of 50 birds and they play the telephone game, then the message travels for 50 birds. If the flock is done with 10,000 birds, then they play the telephone game again and the message travels 10,000 people. So the scale over which they are globally correlated is always as large as the entire system. And this is why they give us this striking appearance of behaving like one.
He thinks that these perfectly synchronized animal group behaviors could be harnessed for new technological innovations. He says that right now, most groups of machines, like drones, move in a follow-the-leader-like fashion. If the leader gets destroyed, the group stops functioning. But
on the other hand, collective behavior in biology is most of the time decentralized, it's distributed behavior. So it's a bottom-up kind of control, and which is much more robust, this kind of control. And so it would be very useful to be able to copy that at the technological level.
Think schools of unmanned submarines that search for underwater mines, or a flock of microscopic robots inside of our bodies that administer medicine. If we can teach those man-made machines to move like synchronized birds, they too could be less vulnerable to predators. For The Pulse, I'm Paige Flager.
The
There are lots of studies that show that birds are very smart creatures, beyond the fact that apparently they are very good at playing telephone. Birds can solve puzzles, they utilize tools, but how do they do that? Their brains are so small. They have bird brains, right? Researcher Susanna Herculana-Huzel has been fascinated by this question. She's a neuroscientist at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, and she says size doesn't matter. It's neurons that count. So I asked her, why are neurons so important?
Well, neurons are the basic information processing units in the brain. They're the cells that get information back and forth, that combine signals, that send them on, and that eventually make something happen. So that's why it's reasonable to expect that the more neurons you have in the brain, the more capabilities that brain will have.
So how did you go about counting neurons in brains?
Well, I realized that the main difficulty with the usual methods where you have to take a whole brain, slice it very, very thinly, and then take them to the microscope is that neurons are distributed very unevenly in the brain. So you might have a very high density here, but a very low density, just a couple of millimeters to the side. And I realized that if you could dissolve the tissue, literally liberate the cells from the tissue, you could actually collect the cell nucleus. Every cell has one and only one nucleus, and you could collect those nuclei in a soup, really, which turns out to be a very, very easy and simple direct way to estimate how many cells they're made of.
And what do you use to dissolve the brains?
It's a detergent found in pretty much any biomedical lab. It's called Triton X100.
Detergent like Tide? No.
Yes, it's a detergent like what you use in your kitchen. You take this lab detergent and dissolve it in sodium citrate. Then you have a salty detergent solution, and that's what you use to grind the tissue in. And then you just work at it for some 15, 20 minutes, and then you have brain soup. I know. My students tell me I've killed apple juice for them, and probably I just did for your listeners too.
So is the basic principle the more neurons you have, the better your brain is?
In principle, yes. And of course, that's something that we would like to test and be able to figure out whether that's really the case. But that is the expectation.
And we want the neurons to be in the forebrain, right?
The neurons in the forebrain are the ones that can do what we call associative processing, which essentially means going well beyond just receiving sensory information and generating responses. I like to think that that's the part of the brain of mammals and birds and also other species that gives you complexity and flexibility to what you can do with your brain.
So size is irrelevant then?
Apparently, yes. An elephant has a bigger brain than humans do, but we still have three times as many neurons in the cerebral cortex, in this association predictive, let's say, part of the brain than elephants do.
So we're smarter than elephants.
I like to think so, yes. We're definitely the ones studying them and not the other way around.
Give me some examples of animals that are very smart and that might surprise us in being smart animals.
Well, I'll just go with the, you know, I'm going to use the expression, the lowly pigeon. In big cities, we learn to hate pigeons. They're considered plague. They're considered dumb animals. It turns out they actually have more neurons in the forebrain than rats. And rats are one of our favorite lab animals because you can train them to do a number of things. You can test their cognitive abilities. It turns out that pigeons are actually pretty good in a number of things that we like to think that rats do. I'll give you an example. Pigeons are able to discriminate between images of people and scrambled images of people. Faces. They can tell different types of objects apart. So in many labs, pigeons are becoming a very interesting lab animal. And, you know, they're pigeons with pigeon-sized brains.
Susanna Herculana-Huzel is a neuroscientist. She teaches psychology at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee. Coming up, when you get bad news about your health, and your brain automatically takes you to the worst place.
I basically just planned out like the whole funeral, who were my pallbearers. In lieu of flowers, I wanted bobbleheads.
Bobbleheads, brain cancer, and big decisions. Stay tuned to The Pulse.
Cancer Treatment Centers of America in Philadelphia supports WHYY, offering clinically qualified cancer patients access to the American Society of Clinical Oncology's TAPER study on the effectiveness of new cancer drugs on specific tumor types. More at cancercenter.com. That's cancercenter.com.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. We're exploring the supercomputer inside of our heads on the show today. And one of the many things that's amazing about our brain is how it processes sensory information. Let's say you're standing on a busy street corner. Cars are rushing past and crowds of people are walking by. You're bombarded with information and your brain is actually processing what you're hearing faster than what you're seeing. Sound is so critical that neuroscientists are beginning to look at it as a way to better understand and perhaps even diagnose brain trauma, like concussions. Here's Max Green with more.
During Addison Zern's first couple weeks of high school, she says she felt like her brain was turning against her.
The first time I went back to the lunchroom, someone had screamed behind me and I immediately got a headache and I'm like, I have to leave.
Addison is 14, has long brown hair, and wears thick-framed glasses. And sound wasn't the only problem. Even low light felt too bright, and she had to wear sunglasses indoors. This hypersensitivity all started after Addison hit her head while swimming in gym class. But she didn't know anything was really wrong until she got out of the water and did what any other teenager would do, checked her text messages.
I noticed that my eyes were darting off different places when I was trying to look at my phone.
When Addison swam full speed into the side of the pool and smacked her head, she suffered a concussion. And that blow changed the way her brain processed the world around her.
And we are interested in trying to understand the biological basis for this.
That's Dr. Nina Kraus, a biologist and neuroscientist at Northwestern University just outside of Chicago. Kraus studies how the brain understands sound and how that understanding changes based on life experience or disease or injury. Of all the things we ask our nervous systems to do, like retrieve information from our skin, our eyes, and our noses, Kraus says making sense of sound is one of the most complex tasks. And to tackle this big job, the brain draws on a lifetime of sound experience to create a kind of map or guide for how we process what we hear.
What we like to do is use a mixing board analogy.
You know, like a DJ or audio engineer uses when they're mixing a song. Imagine your brain is the audio engineer, mixing the sound as it comes in, moving the sliders up and down to make certain parts fade into the background and other parts more audible and clear. The brain might have one slider represent timing, how fast or slow a sound comes in. Another might be for pitch, how high or low we interpret that sound. One might be for timbre, how robust or thin a sound is. But a blow to the head can jostle those sliders, send them out of whack, cause confusion, disorientation, and general disorder. Scientists like Kraus can measure these settings and how they change really precisely.
As I'm talking to you now, the neurons in your brain that respond to sound are producing electricity.
So when researchers in Kraus's lab study the brain, they give participants earbuds and play them a sound like this.
I want you to get up right now and go to the window. Open it.
That's a clip from the 1976 movie Network.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
Right away, the sound processing machinery in the brain starts to produce electricity, which is detected by electrodes stuck on the head. The electrodes then feed that response into a computer, where it shows up looking a lot like a sound wave, a solid, wavy line with peaks and valleys smushed in close together. The idea is to use these representations of how the brain hears sound as a kind of biomarker, a consistent, measurable baseline or range that could be used to diagnose trauma in the brain. So after a blow to the head, like one that might give you a concussion, that same clip could sound something like,
I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as bad as hell, and I'm not...
In a study from December, Krause's team measured these kinds of changes. They were able to correctly diagnose concussions in 90% of pediatric patients, including 14-year-old swimmer Addison. With just 40 participants, the study out of Krause's lab is small. But establishing these changes as a possible biomarker may prove to be an important step toward developing a reliable, objective diagnostic tool for concussions.
There isn't really a gold standard, I guess you could say, for diagnosing a concussion.
That's Kristen Doms O'Connor, a neurologist at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York and co-director of the Brain Injury Research Center. She says concussions are most often diagnosed through subjective assessments. Physicians use their best judgment to look for symptoms like headache, amnesia, confusion, dizziness, imbalance, or blurred vision.
There's a lot of research looking into biomarkers, objective biomarkers. Many of those options are very expensive. They're invasive.
Doms O'Connor says the Northwestern study findings are preliminary but exciting, and they could lead to an inexpensive, non-invasive test. Krause, the Northwestern researcher studying sound processing, says being able to access this information could lead to a new world of understanding the nature of the brain. She gave me one more example to help illustrate what she means. Take a listen to this clip of a Mozart composition. First, you'll hear the music like we normally hear it. Then it changes. The second section is a recording of someone's brain finishing the tune. As the music passes through the ears, the brain hears and mimics the sound, but with electrical impulses. Again, that second part was the brain using electricity to produce its own version of the music, and researchers can record and capture that. For The Pulse, I'm Max Green.
We're talking about the brain on today's show, this beautiful, mysterious, and powerful organ in our heads. And a lot of us use a lot of our brain power to worry, to imagine different things that might happen. Sometimes we do this needlessly, and sometimes not. About 4 years ago, Jeremy Hoffman was 30 years old, and he told his wife, Rebecca, about some weird symptoms he was having. He felt a tingling on the left side of his body. He was getting headaches. He was often exhausted. Rebecca is a doctor, and she started to think about worst-case scenarios.
I think at one time I remember sitting here at the table and being like, do you know that I think that this could be a tumor?
Yeah.
And I don't remember what your response was, but it took me like days to get up the nerve to say that that's what I thought it was.
My response was probably just like, you know too much. It's not going to happen.
Jeremy made a doctor's appointment at the hospital in Philadelphia where Rebecca works, and he went to get an MRI.
I texted her as soon as it was over, said, I'm done. I'm going to go back to work. And
I shouldn't have looked, but I decided that I needed to look because I just couldn't wait to know what it looked like. And so I pulled it up on our computer and I just kind of, I'm great at reading body CT scans. I'm not great at reading MRIs, but you didn't have to, it was not hard to see. You didn't have to be good at reading MRIs of brains to see that there was a really big problem. And so at that point, I don't even know what I did. I think I said, oh my God. And I wanted to cry, but I didn't want to cry. I was just like so shocked.
Then she comes through the door. So
he said, it's bad, isn't it? That was the worst day of my life.
Monday morning, it was the surgery.
It was hard for me. I said, Jeremy, I have my scrubs. Can I just go back to the operating room with you? I won't stay. I won't stay for the operation, but can I just go back with you? Because I totally wanted to take advantage of the fact that I could go back with him. And he was like, no way. No. Stay out there. You're not a doctor right now. Just stay out there. The surgery went very well. But if they had taken everything, he would have been left paralyzed on the left side of his body. So, of course, we wouldn't have wanted that for him in terms of quality of life. So they left a rim of tumor, which he then got chemotherapy and radiation to that area. I think my understanding is that this will come back at some point. Like, he's not totally cured of this. It's not like he has brain cancer. And right now, all those cells are quiet and they're dormant. but that at any time they can and they probably will come back.
You know, again, I don't want to set myself up for disappointment to say that it's never can happen, but there is the chance that we hope that, we hope that it doesn't happen. But yeah, it could be 20 years, 30 years, could be tomorrow.
In the first year after he was diagnosed, I still was holding on to a lot of hope that we would be able to start a family. And at that time, especially early on, Jeremy was very adamant that he did not want kids any longer because he was really afraid of leaving them.
That was the biggest hesitation for me.
For that first year, like, it was also not only hard for me to think that my husband was going to die at some unknown period of time and not know, but also that I'd always thought that we were going to be parents. Like, it never occurred to me that we wouldn't be parents. And all of a sudden, we went from getting ready to start having a family to now I'm never going to be a mom and he's never going to be a dad.
I couldn't bring myself to do it knowing that this possibility was there. And now the possibility is still there. But there's more of a, there is now a greater chance that my kid would then know who I was and I would be able to enjoy my kid for more than a day or a couple weeks or a year. And,
you know, we just decided, you know what, this is what it is. And our life is going to go on and we're going to just, you know, I have my career to go back to. Darren wanted to go back to work. We always planned to have kids. So we're going to have a child and life goes on. And it doesn't have to be like some extravagant thing, but you know, we're just going to live. And then, you know, every 3 months, we'll like remember that you have cancer and we're going to go get the scan. But until then, like in the interim time, we're just going to be. So then along came Noah.
Yes. Say eagle.
He's been great. I think there were some times early on we were like, oh my gosh, why did we do this again? It was a challenging little teeny baby. But now, I mean, of course, he's the love of our lives. He, like, says all these words, and he's walking and loves baseball like his dad. Yeah, and now we're thinking of working on another one.
Yeah. We were just talking about it tonight.
Yeah.
About when and when's a good time.
We definitely have transitioned to be a little bit more live in the moment. Yeah. I will say that I have trouble seeing us old. I have trouble seeing us old. Yeah. So I can see this. I think that's, I like live in the short term, more like, you know, not like days, months, whatever, years, long enough that like I can see, you know, us having a bigger family and yeah, me like us having a career and having a house with a pool someday and like, and doing those things. But I, you know, those commercials, oh my God, the commercials with like, you know, old couples holding hands. There was something on the Today Show one day and I was sitting at home doing work. Darren wasn't here. And there were they had invited all of these like elderly couples to this ballroom and they like taught them how to dance. And I was like in tears. I don't know. I just have trouble seeing us being really old.
Well, I'm not going to dance before I'm 80. I'm definitely not going to dance after I'm 80. So, yeah.
Jeremy is doing well, and he and Rebecca are trying to have another baby. Paige Flager produced this piece. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Alana Gordon, Irina Zhurov, and Elizabeth Fiedler. Alex Stern is our intern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. We had help producing the show this week from Joel Wolfram. Paige Flager is our associate producer, Tanya English, the managing editor, and Megan Pinto, the executive producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare.
Penn Medicine's Heart and Vascular Center supports WHYY with over 20 community cardiology practices throughout Pennsylvania and New Jersey. Penn's Heart and Vascular Center has made a commitment to deliver advanced treatment options, personalized care, and convenient access close to home. Learn more about Penn's Heart and Vascular Center at pennheart.org or 800-789-PEN. Your life is worth Penn Medicine. Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse. Independence is coming to your neighborhood to help you understand healthcare options. Licensed agents can help prepare you for whatever may be ahead. Learn more at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless. Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.